Greetings.
Greetings, this is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today, October 13th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. Coming up a little bit later in our program for this week, we'll be, of course, examining regular Pan-African Newswire reports. And in this week's Pan-African Newswire, we're going to be dealing with the extraordinary summit held in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, of the African Union to discuss the role of the African Union member states along with the International Criminal Court. Stay tuned. This program, of course, will be available later on. We'll give you information on how you can log on to the Pan-African Newswire. Today, we're also going to have additional reports dealing with some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. So stay tuned, and of course, we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe.
Thank you.
Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And a little bit later on in the program, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports, and there will be a lot of very interesting and probing information in this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
I am a free My little twin was only 3 months, so it was his first appearance in my business. It was special to me every time.
Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal.
Thank you.
And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And today, October 13th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. We'd like to welcome all of our listeners back to our program for this week. And of course, the Pan-African Journal will be available to all listeners. All you have to do is log on to our website at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And you can have access to this program. And of course, we encourage everyone to share the contents of this program as broadly as possible. And we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today, October 13th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. So stay tuned for more of this week's program. Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Thank you. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And in just a few minutes' time, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. And in this week's Pan-African Newswire, we're going to be dealing with some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today, Sunday, October 13th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. I want to welcome all of our listeners back to this special worldwide radio broadcast for today. We just heard the sound of Brenda Fassie from the Republic of South Africa. And before that, we heard the sound from Yvonne Shaka Shaka, also from the Republic of South Africa. Right now, we're going to move into our regular Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, we're going to be dealing with the following stories. The African Union Extraordinary Summit held in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The Continental Organization made an appeal for the International Criminal Court to withdraw charges from the leaders of the Republic of Sudan and Kenya. A raid by Navy SEALs into Somalia last weekend failed after it was repelled by the Al-Shabaab Islamic Resistance Organization. Al-Shabaab opened fire on the U.S. assassination squad, opened fire on their forces, and they were forced to retreat. Some reports indicate that the raid was based on false intelligence from the Central Intelligence Agency. The economic fallout from the lockout of 800,000 federal employees could have a detrimental impact on the economies throughout the world. The leading capitalist corporations are responsible through their funding of both political parties that dominate the United States Congress. And finally, access has been restored to food supplemental programs across 17 states in the United States. Food stamp cards were reported to be dysfunctional, where people could not access their usage. And the African Union has resolved that no sitting head of state on the continent should be brought before any international tribunal for prosecution, in line with universally agreed statutes that grant them immunity. In a landmark decision aimed at rebuffing the International Criminal Court's relentless attacks on African leaders, the bloc also resolved to dispatch a high-powered delegation to New York to request the United Nations Security Council to defer criminal proceedings against Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto. The two leaders are facing charges of instigating post-election violence that rocked the East African country between 2007 and early 2008, leaving more than 1,000 dead and displacing thousands. Speaking to journalists soon after returning from the African Union Extraordinary Summit in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia last night, President Mugabe said there was ongoing debate concerning the International Criminal Court membership of African countries that ratify the Rome Statute. He said the African Union could, however, only make recommendations to the states. Quote, opposition is clear. We do not support the ICC. We did not become a member of the ICC. And our position is that people must get out of the ICC. There are 34 members of the African Union who are in the International Criminal Court. Mugabe went on to say that, quote, our view is that the members have their own capacity because it is not the African Union that must take action as such. The African Union can only recommend to them, and we members who did not, you know, become members of the ICC can only recommend to those who are members that they leave, unquote, said the president. He went on to say that, quote, so there is a debate. Some say, no, let's wait until the matter has gone to the Security Council. But in the meantime, the ICC should defer the matter and not insist on Uhuru Kenyatta, President of Kenya, coming for trial on November the 12th. Quote, so the debate was still on, and we will get to know what remained, but most heads of state left after speaking and making their contributions, unquote. Also speaking to journalists last night, Foreign Minister Mr. Simbarashi Mumbingigwe gave a detailed insight into what really transpired during the summit. He said President Mugabe was among the leaders who spoke strongly on the need to guarantee sitting heads of state immunity from prosecution. He said the president made it clear that the laws of individual countries set aside legal action against leaders until their terms of office expired. More than 20 other heads of state at the summit concurred. Quote, as you know, out of the 54 states in Africa, 34 are member parties of the Rome Statute that form the International Criminal Court. There has been a lot of unhappiness in Africa about the way it has operated. It is absolutely amazing that of the 33 cases before the International Criminal Court, all of them are against Africans. So when they went to the extreme of inviting a head of state who is in office, Africa felt they had gone too far. Now, this is why the extraordinary summit was called. We have got President al-Bashir from Sudan, who was indicted at this time. They have invited both the president and his deputy. So President Kenyatta wanted his colleague to provide the necessary advice on the issue on what Kenya should do. Quote, President Mugabe made a very strong intervention on the issue, making it very clear that Africa should not accept a situation where head of state and government who is still in office can be paraded in a full court, whatever the circumstances. Heads of state from all over the world enjoy immunity while they are in office, and this immunity must apply universally. You cannot have a situation where you say a president who is immune from prosecution in his own country can be taken out of his country for prosecution in another country. The position was adopted by the summit that no head of state or anyone who is in a position to act as head of state should ever appear before any international tribunal when you are still in office. So this has been resolved, unquote. Now, Mr. Mumbingigwe said, the summit also took the position that Mr. Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto should not go to the Hague-based court. Instead, a high-powered delegation comprising a representative from each of Africa's five regions will visit New York to engage the United Nations Security Council over the indictment of a sitting head of state. Now, Ethiopian Prime Minister and African Union Chairman, Mr. Haile Mariam Desalegn, will head the delegation. Mr. Mum Bengigwe said African leaders will meet again next month to decide the way forward if the concerns are not addressed. He pointed out that while the head of state were given to the correct application of justice, they do not condone impunity. Quote, the African Union has gone further to say that President Kenyatta should not go to The Hague to appear before this tribunal. And secondly, the proceedings, which have already started with Deputy President Ruto, should be terminated in terms of this resolution. Quote, the African Union has decided to send a high-powered delegation to New York to go and engage the United Nations Security Council on the issue of the ICC indicting heads of state and government who are in office. The delegation shall consist of one representative from each of the five regions, and it will be led by the current chair of the African Union. So they are going to engage the Security Council and permanent members of the Security Council to get the ICC to stop its investigations. Now, if the issue raised by the African Union is not taken seriously, then the African Union will hold another summit towards the end of November to decide what action to take. Quote, this is because at the summit, heads of state were concerned that Africa was getting a raw deal from the International Criminal Court. And this is the point that President Mugabe made for prosecution. George Bush and Blair about the atrocities that they committed in Iraq, Afghanistan and their support, for example, to rebels in Syria and what they did to Libya. All those should be convenient targets of the International Criminal Court, but nobody is talking about indicting, unquote. The AU Extraordinary Summit was convened to review Africa's relations with the International Criminal Court following the indictment of Mr. Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto. The two joined a list of many other Africans who were apparent targets of the court's unfair justice system. A key issue to emerge was the possible pullout from the International Criminal Court by the 34 African signatories to the Rome Statute, the court's founding treaty. Although the matter divided opinion, there was consensus on the need for the continent to act on the court's questionable operations. So far, the court has indicted two sitting heads of state, Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir and the late Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Former Liberian President Charles Taylor was also brought before the court. So was Cote d'Ivoire former leader Mr. Laurent Gbagbo. The court alleged that Colonel Gaddafi ordered the killing of civilians in the preliminary stages of the Libyan uprising in 2011, a claim that continues to be challenged. Mr. Gbagbo, it is alleged, played a role in the post-election conflict that killed thousands in his country during 2010. In his opening remarks at the summit, Mr. Desalegn said, quote, the double standard that both the United Nations Security Council and the ICC have displayed with regards to the African Union's request for a deferral for prosecution in a number of cases has been particularly worrisome, unquote. Meanwhile, President Mugabe returned home last night. He was welcomed at Harare International Airport by Vice President Joyce Majuru, Minister of State for Presidential Affairs, Mr. Didamas Mutasa, Information, Media, and Broadcasting Services Minister, Professor Jonathan Moyo, the Minister of State responsible for Harare's Metropolitan Province, Miriam Chikukwa, and Chief Secretary to the President and Cabinet, Dr. Meshek Sabanda, as well as service chiefs. And the African Union has ratcheted up its pressure on the International Criminal Court to suspend cases against the leaders of Kenya and Sudan with a unanimous decision to ask the United Nations Security Council to defer the trials for as long as the men remain in office. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And it's been reported that the United States, which engaged in a military intervention last weekend in the Horn of Africa nation of Somalia, this intervention was repelled as a result of the defensive tactics of the Al-Shabaab Islamic Resistance Organization, which has been targeted by the United States and its allies throughout the East and the Horn of Africa. Now, the Americans' target was an innocuous two-story beachside house in Barawe, located in southern Somalia. It's a fishing town of about 200,000 people that was a crucial slave trading port during the colonial era. In particular, they had planned the delicate operation of capturing, not killing, Abdul Qadir, Muhammad Abdul Qadir, a Kenyan of Somali origin and a senior commander of Al-Shabaab, who was linked to a number of so-called terrorist plots. The house, about 200 meters from the sea on the town's east side, is understood to be used by so-called foreign extremists who have gone to Somalia to take up Al-Shabaab's cause. The group's presence there was not news to Sheikh. According to one individual named Sheikh, quote, "I live in a house near the beach and I used to see the house every day. There were so many Al-Shabaab fighters entering and coming out," unquote, she said. She went on to say that, quote, "I usually see them going back and forth, but I had never thought that so important a person was living inside the house," unquote. Now, early morning gunfire was unusual, Sheikh continued, except when Al-Shabaab was conducting training exercises. Quote, "I raised my ears and I continued to hear the gunfire growing. I had no feeling or thought of such an attack from the Americans. I looked at my watch about 30 minutes later and heard one explosion, and then a few minutes later, another explosion occurred, like boom," unquote. What had been invisible to Sheikh and other residents of Barawe was the stealthy advance of Navy SEAL team of about six, the same unit that killed, supposedly killed, Osama bin Laden in Pakistan just 2.5 years ago in a speedboat towards the Somalian coastline before the first light. The team consisted of about 20 SEALs, according to leaked accounts, and their craft was flanked on the Indian Ocean by three small boats to provide a backup. They look like three big cows, and that's according to the eyewitnesses. The SEALs swept ashore, but not everyone in Barawe was asleep in those chilly early morning hours. Abdul Rahman Yaro, a longtime resident of the town, recalled, quote, "I was wrapping my turban on my neck and head to protect against the cold and heading to the mosque. When I had nearly entered it, I heard a sound behind me. I saw what looked like three big cows going towards the north of the mosque. It was dark, so I could not identify well what they were." He went on to say that after only 10 minutes, I heard the first guns, that is, where the gun battle occurred between Al-Shabaab fighters in the house and United States forces. I now understand the big cows I saw on the right were the American Special Forces with their military bags on their backs going in the direction of the house they targeted, unquote. The SEALs took up positions inside the house's compound, according to a report by the international press, which continued, quote, "Then a lone Al-Shabaab fighter walked out into plain view, smoked a cigarette, and went back inside. One source familiar with the details of the raid said the fighter played it cool and gave no indication that he had spotted the SEALs, but he came back out shooting, firing rounds from an AK-47 assault rifle," unquote. The element of surprise had been lost, and Al-Shabaab fighters unleashed gunfire and grenades in a cacophony that rang out across the town, murdering sleepy dog before prayers. But the Americans continued on the offensive, according to an elder who did not wish to be named. Quote, "The attackers from the U.S. divided into two groups," he said. He went on to say that group one, comprising six men, stormed the house and began shooting the people inside it, while group two, also at least six men, were staying outside the house. The worst shooting took place inside, where one Al-Shabaab fighter was killed. Al-Shabaab had more fighters inside, and they fought extremely hard against the Americans, unquote. The elder continued, quote, "The Americans tried to enter room by room into the house to start searching for the big fish, but Al-Shabaab got reinforcing fighters from other houses, and then the situation deteriorated until the Americans retreated," unquote. Now, according to various international press accounts, several SEALs could see Abdul Qadir through windows, but he was heavily protected. According to Al-Shabaab, he was not in the building. While Pentagon officials have been reluctant to provide a full narrative, they have said U.S. forces retreated from the gun battle out of concern for potential civilian casualties. Details leaked to the press suggest that the compound contained far more women and children than the SEALs had expected. The commandos returned to their boat, grateful for having suffered no casualties. That's according to the Pentagon. Of course, this situation and the reports may change as more information comes out. Sheikh recalled that, quote, at 3 a.m., the call for prayer started and all the gunfire stopped. A neighbor called me on the phone and said there's an attack against the Mujahideen. When it became safe enough to see everything outside, I came out to look around. Outside the house, which came under attack, there were some fighters of al-Shabaab and some residents came to witness the incident. She went on to say that these al-Shabaab fighters were not talking to the people. Some of them were masked and could not see their faces. I saw one dead man, and he was loaded into a car for burial. They were saying the martyr, which is only the only word that you can understand for an al-Shabaab member who's been killed, unquote. Now, the dead man, Abdul Qadir's body, according to one source in the town. On Tuesday, the Somali Defense Minister, Abdi Hakim Haji Mahmoud Fakih, claimed two al-Shabaab members had been killed. Quote, we have found that two senior commanders, one of them foreign, were killed in the attack, despite the top target not being found, unquote. A United Nations official in Somalia also said two al-Shabaab figures had been killed, one Sudanese man and another of Somali and Swedish origin. Sheikh continued that, quote, there were more fighters and supporters of al-Shabaab coming to the house in the morning. They were vowing that they would kill anyone who was found working with the non-believers. Quote, on the beach, the residents were looking at items left by the United States forces. I saw a gray military bulletproof jacket. There was also blood scattered on the ground. There were military boots on the ground, which were suspect were those of the U.S. forces. Now, in the aftermath of the U.S. assault, al-Shabaab deployed more heavily armed fighters to patrol the streets of Barawi, while also posting men and anti-aircraft weapons on the beach. There was also local backlash with a hunt for suspected informants who helped United States intelligence locate the house. A man who frequently used a local internet cafe was arrested on Sunday and is still being held. Al-Shabaab took control of Barawi in 2008, and it became a refuge for its senior officials after they lost control of the capital of Mogadishu and other towns during 2011. These have included the leaders Ahmed Gordani, who has been described as Africa's most wanted man after the Westgate Mall bombing in Nairobi, Omar Hamami, the so-called jihadist rapper from Alabama, killed last month after falling out with Gordani and Abdul Qadir himself. Barawi is about 130 miles, about 218 kilometers from Mogadishu, the nearest town where the government and African Union forces have control in Shalanbahubud, only 68 or 110 kilometers away. To the east is the Amaresa training camp for al-Shabaab's foreign fighters. The events of Saturday, October 5th, could boost al-Shabaab's confidence in its defenses, but also give it notice that the world's most powerful military is ready to bring the battle to its doorsteps. Speaking at a mosque in Barawi on Monday night, al-Shabaab's military operations spokesman Sheikh Abiasis Abu Musab said, quote, the Western countries have to bear in mind, we know that we are your target, but we will not be caught off guard. He went on to say that we know you are sharpening your knives to cut off our heads. We know our enemies. We will not oversleep, so you can attack us at once. We are always vigilant, and your cowardly attacks will end in failure, unquote. Now, David Gartenstein Ross, who studies Somalia and al-Shabaab at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, described Barawi as, quote, right now the strongest area of sanctuary, unquote, for the Islamic resistance movement. He said it was likely that al-Shabaab expected something like a foreign raid after it perpetuated the attack on Nairobi's Westgate Mall. Gardiston Ross said the probable immediate response by al-Shabaab would center around strengthening its internal security and grip on Barawi rather than launching another attack. Quote, the raid has made them very nervous. In Barawi, it's already been reported that al-Shabaab has implemented curfews. There will be an uptick in operational security, and they will certainly use the way they repulsed this attack by Navy SEALs as a propaganda piece, unquote. The United States Defense Secretary, Chuck Hagel, said the operation in Somalia, along with a near simultaneous one in Libya, demonstrated the, quote, unparalleled precision, global reach, and capabilities, unquote, of U.S. counterterrorism. Quote, these operations in Libya and Somalia send a strong message to the world that the United States will spare no effort to hold terrorists accountable, no matter where they hide and how long they evade justice, unquote, the Secretary of Defense Hagel said. Pentagon spokesman George Little suggested that more special operations raids against al-Shabaab were yet to come. He said that, quote, working in partnership with the government of the Federal Republic of Somalia, the United States military will continue to confront the threat posed by al-Shabaab, unquote, Little said in a statement that was released just this last past Monday. He said that, quote, the United States military was unmatched in its capabilities and could rely on any of them to disrupt terrorist networks and plots, unquote. However, despite the bragging and boasting, this was a situation where the United States Special Forces, the Navy SEALs, failed to carry out what they considered a successful raid against the al-Shabaab Islamic Resistance Movement that is based in the Horn of Africa nation of Somalia. Now, America's greatest minds of business and finance have reached a consensus on the government shutdown and, worse, the prospects of a debt default. Now, while the latter is worse, both are bad. Those same great minds are well aware how the shutdown came to pass and why default still looms on the horizon, whether next week, next month, or next year. Now, that's according to an article written by Joe Knanson that was published in Altenet on October the 11th. The article says that, yes, the frightened corporate leaders surely know how this happened because their money funded the Tea Party candidates and organizations responsible for the crisis. Consider Representative Ted Yoho, a Republican of Florida, a Tea Party freshman whose outspoken stupidity on the default's potential benefits, such as an improved U.S. credit rating, has provided a bit of dark humor in these dark days. Yoho, a large animal veterinarian, announced months ago that he would never vote to raise the debt ceiling. Like most Republican candidates, he had no problem raising contributions from business interests, notably including contractors, insurance companies, manufacturers, and agricultural processors, all of which presumably share the horror of default expressed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. But no doubt Yoho parroted the usual right-wing cliches about taxes, regulation, labor, and health care, so all the business guys wrote a check without caring that Yoho is an ignorant yobo. Now, according to this same article published in Altenet, or consider Representative Martin Stutzman, who is a Republican from Indiana, who came to embody the idiocy of the shutdown when he declared, quote, we're not going to be disrespected, unquote, by the White House, but couldn't articulate precisely what Republicans needed in order to reopen the government and avoid default. Another low-wattage Tea Party newcomer, Stutzman likewise raised plenty of money from commercial banks, real estate firms, insurance companies, and various manufacturers. Why do these executives write checks to elect someone like him, is the question asked by the Altenet article. Then there are Tea Party leaders in the upper chamber, including such adornments of democracy as Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican of Wisconsin, and of course Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican of Texas. Johnson says there needn't be a debt default no matter what Congress does, while Cruz, the, quote, defund Obamacare, unquote, mastermind, is more culpable than any other single legislature for the paralysis gripping Washington and the country. Johnson's top donors include an investment firm called Fiduciary Management, Inc., ironically enough, as well as the Northwestern Mutual, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Mass Mutual Life Insurance, and naturally Koch Industries, which now claims disingenuously that it doesn't favor the Cruz shutdown strategy or debt default. As for Cruz of Texas, guess who paid for his campaign? Very close to the top of the list of donors for the despised Texan is none other than Goldman Sachs, whose chairman, Lloyd Blankfein, showed up at the White House a few days ago to bemoan the catastrophic threat of default. Not only did Blankfein and his fellow bankers warn of what might happen if America breaches its full faith and credit, but he even hinted that the fault lies with Republican hostage takers, which is only partially right because Blankfein and his fellow financiers need to look in the mirror too. Cruz also got a big check from Berkshire Hathaway, corporate home of the venerated Wall Street sage, Warren Buffett, who just compared the impact of the default to a, quote, nuclear bomb, unquote. If that nuclear wipes out the markets, Berkshire's investment in Cruz will have lit the fuse. If any of these business leaders honestly cared about fiscal responsibility and economic growth, let alone the contested threat of shutdowns and defaults, they could step up to warn the Republicans that the money won't be there anymore unless they cease and desist from such assaults on democracy. They have more than enough money and power to end this crisis and make sure it never happens again, but they seem to lack the necessary character as well as the necessary courage. And finally, people in 17 states found themselves unable to buy groceries with their food stamp debit style cards just on Saturday after a routine check by a vendor, Xerox Corporation, resulted in a system failure. Xerox announced late in the evening that access had been restored for users in 17 states affected by the outage, hours after the first problems were reported. Quote, restarting the EBT system required time to ensure service was back at full functionality, unquote. And that's according to a spokesman, Jennifer Wassmeyer, and she said this in an email. Now, Xerox spokeswoman Karen Arena told the international press that some electronic benefits transfer systems were experiencing connectivity issues after a routine test of a backup system at a location in the Midwest caused an outage at about 10 a.m. Eastern Time. The test was part of a regular maintenance schedule, Arena said. Xerox started receiving calls soon afterwards. U.S. Department of Agriculture spokeswoman Courtney Rao underscored that the outage was not related to the federal government shutdown. Xerox runs EPD card systems for 17 states. All were affected by the outage. Ohio's cash and food assistance card payment systems went down at 11 a.m., said Benjamin Johnson, a spokesman for the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. Shoppers left carts of groceries behind at a packed Market Basket grocery store in Biddeford, Maine, because they couldn't get their benefits, said fellow shopper Barbara Coleman of Saco, Maine. The manager put up a sign saying the EBT system was not in use. Coleman, who receives the benefits, called on an 800 telephone line for the program, and it said the system was down due to maintenance, she said. Quote, that's a problem. There's a lot of families who are not going to be able to feed children because the system is being maintained, unquote, Coleman said. No one should be put maintenance during the daytime, unquote. She planned to reach out to local officials. Quote, I'm trying to reach out to everybody because I'm not thinking of me, an adult, who can figure out things. I'm thinking of the simpler person in the world who is sitting there trying to just do basic shopping to feed their kids. You don't want children going hungry tonight because of stupidity, unquote, she said. Coleman said the store manager promised her that he would honor the day's store flyer discounts next week. Illinois residents began reporting problems with their cards, known as Link in that state, on Saturday, said Janaru Smith, spokesman for the Illinois Department of Human Services. Smith said that typically when the cards aren't working, retailers can call a backup phone number to find out how much money a customer has available in their account. But that information also was unavailable because of the outage, so customers weren't able to use their cards. In Clarksdale, Mississippi, one of the poorest parts of one of the poorest states in the nation, cashier Eliza Shook said dozens of customers at Corner Grocery had to put back groceries when the cards failed on Saturday because they couldn't afford to pay for the food. After several hours, she put a sign on the door to tell people about the problem. Quote, it's been terrible, unquote, Shook said in a phone interview. Quote, it's just been some angry folks. That's what a lot of folks depend on, unquote. Mississippi Department of Human Services Director Ricky Berry confirmed that Xerox, the state's EBT vendor, had computer problems. He said he had been told by mid-afternoon that the problems were being fixed. Quote, I know there are a lot of mad people, unquote, Berry said. Sherry Powell, a spokeswoman for the Oklahoma Department of Human Services, started receiving calls around 11:30 a.m. about problems with the state's card systems. More than 600,000 Oklahomans received SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional assistance program benefits, which is another word for food stamps, and money is dispersed to the cards on the 1st, 5th, and 10th days of every month. So the disruption came at what is typically a high use time for the cards. Oklahoma also runs a separate debt card system, debit card system for other state benefits like unemployment payments. Those cards can be used at ATMs to withdraw cash. Powell said Xerox administrators, both the EBT and the debit card system, and they both were down initially. Like Ohio's Johnson, Powell said that Oklahoma's debt cash debit card system has since been restored, but the EBT cards for the SNAP programs were still down. Powell said Oklahoma's Xerox representative told them that the problem stemmed from a power failure at the data center and power had been restored. It just takes a while to reboot these systems, unquote, she said, adding that she did not know when the data center where the data center was located. Powell said that some grocery store cashiers had been speculating that the federal government shutdown caused the problem, but state officials have been assured that that was not the case. Quote, we are hopeful it will be up this morning or this afternoon, but we were not given a specific time, unquote, she said. And, of course, David Arkley, a spokesman for Michigan's Department of Human Services, also confirmed that residents in his states have reported problems using their food stamp cards. And with that, we're going to conclude this Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, we'd like to recap the major stories in the Pan-African Newswire segment for the Pan-African Journal this week. The African Union Extraordinary Summit held in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, discussed the continental organization's thrust towards the International Criminal Court. The AU made a statement appealing for the International Criminal Court to withdraw charges from the leaders of the Republic of Sudan as well as the Republic of Kenya. A raid by Navy SEALs into Somalia last weekend failed after it was repelled by the Al-Shabaab Islamic Resistance fighters who are based in Somalia. Al-Shabaab opened fire on the U.S. assassination squad forces. They were forced into a retreat. Some reports indicate that the raid was based on false information from the Central Intelligence Agency. The economic fallout from the lockout of 800,000 federal employees could have a detrimental impact on the economies throughout the world. The leading capitalist corporations are responsible through their funding of both political parties that dominate the United States Congress. And finally, access has been restored to food supplemental nutritional programs across 17 states in the United States. Food stamp cards were reported to be dysfunctional, where people could not access their usage and consequently could not purchase food. And with that, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers, magazines, journals, and research reports, blogs, and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is go to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And doing that, you can log on to the Pan-African Newswire. And we'll be right back with more of this week's program.
I was blind, but then we went to talk. Meanwhile, the 1%, remember Occupy? The richest percentile of Americans have made more money recently than at any previous period in the nation's history. This isn't just a conservative program. It is also a neoliberal program that prays at the altar of Wall Street. The neoliberal program of surrender to market forces has strengthened and energized rightist tendencies and made the market the very center of national life, not the people. So schools closed one day, government shut down doors the next. The market prevails. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
There is so much we can say about Mum Yvonne Chaka Chaka, a musical legend who enriches us not only with her lyrics and groove, but she opens up her heart and helps people across Africa to build their lives for the better. Well, she opened up her home to us. We took our cameras and got to speak to the Princess of Africa.
Yvonne Chaka Chaka, it's one of the most recognizable names in Mzansi. Well, in Africa for that matter. And it gives our South Africans such a sense of pride to know that this remarkable woman is one of our own. With a music career spanning more than three decades and having received a Lifetime Achievement Award at the SAMAs and the South African Traditional Music Awards, she's proved herself to be a force to be reckoned with in the world of the arts. But she's also an inspirational woman with a powerful global influence as a humanitarian. And when she flashes that trademark smile of hers, it's easy to see why she's called the Princess of Africa. When did you first get your big break?
My very first break was in 1985. I just finished matric. The SABC were looking for girls between the ages of 19 and 25 to come and do some auditions. It was a long queue. All you could see were these great men with grey shoes and strong white men just walking. You know, a guy called Louis came to the SABC bringing those round big tapes. So he said, I brought these here to the SABC. As a matter of fact, my boss is looking for a female to come and record. So he says, you know what, I want to audition you. So I'm looking at this white man with a knife, you know. So I go to the boardroom. The song is playing. He says, do you love the song? I'm like, yeah, you know. He says, gosh, you're cheeky. I'm like, I know, you know. So he says, can you sing? When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me. Speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Then Holly said, I found my girl. That's how he found me.
Yvonne Chaka Chaka has since performed with people like Bono, who you're friends with, you had his number on your telephone, Annie Lennox, Beyonce even. What's it like performing with these international artists?
I'm never starstruck. So I look at them like human beings. I look at them and say, these are just human beings like you and me. And I mean, I've met people like Miriam Makeba, Hugh Masekela. Those, for me, are my real stars because they are my people. Correct. I can feel them. I can touch them. They're not surrounded by bodyguards and things like that.
What's Yvonne like as a mom?
I want to think I'm a very good mother. I've got four sons and a daughter. I really love my children. Tomorrow, if my son says to me, I'm bringing a white girl, that's okay. That's what he wants, and that's what makes him happy. If he says, I want to bring an Indian girl or an albino, or I just have to be happy for that. And that's it. And if he says, I'm bringing Peter home, I have to respect that and say that's okay.
Welcome, my son, Temba. You are free.
Hey.
You are free.
27 K's in, but never quitting.
Besides nurturing her international singing career and raising and taking care of her family, she's a goodwill ambassador for the United Nations Children's Fund and advises several company boards on education. She's also very vocal about the effects of global warming and malaria in Africa. Who are your heroes or icons when you were growing up?
Miriam Makeba, you know, the late Miriam Makeba. She was like a mother to me. Every time I'd gone performing, she'd come home and cook for my husband and my children.
Come on.
Yeah, she was just amazing. When I met Miriam, I met her for the first time in New York in 1987. She was cooking. You know, and she was like, I hear you and Brenda Fassbender are doing it in South Africa. Some of us will never go back to South Africa, so do it, my child.
And we became friends since then. You know, his 60th birthday was held here at my house. We had Oliver Tambo coming, we had Madiba coming, we had so many people coming here. Madiba called twice. And Mfumu, because he's a young one, he's rushing to the phone. Hello, hello. He said, can I speak to your mother? The second time when Madiba called him, Mfumu said, why are you always calling mommy? Are you mommy's boyfriend?
Oh.
And I didn't hear my son say that, but then Madiba on the other side, I pick up the phone and he was laughing. Who answered the phone? I said, it's my son. He said, ha, ha, ha. He is asking me such funny questions, you know, because I called the last time. He likes a phone. The young man likes a phone, eh? And so it was, like, very funny. And he came here, and I must say, the man is selfless. He just came to thank us, to say, you know, we know that you did your bit when we were in jail. You did your bit to beat the system. And, you know, I really cried. I had tears in my eyes because who am I to be visited by the great men of the world?
What kind of legacy do you want to leave behind?
As a South African, I always say to myself, I fought the injustices of apartheid, but now there's the injustices of health, injustices of education. Things are not equal until we can all say we are equal and the world is leveled for everybody. I'll still continue fighting until I go to my grave.
And that was an insert featuring South African artist Yvonne Shaka Shaka. And, of course, before that, we heard the voice of the voiceless, Mumia Abu-Jamal, discussing the issue of the government shutdown, of course, being the federal lockout of federal workers that now is well into its second week. And, of course, it is causing a tremendous amount of difficulties and problems. And, of course, many of the multinational corporations, which today are crying about the possible financial disaster that will follow this government lockout of federal employees, they themselves had funded most of these corporations. Most of these politicians were funded by these corporations and by these banks. And of course, they have to be behind the agenda that is being put forward now in Washington, D.C. And right now, we're going to go back to review last month's United Nations General Assembly, which was held in New York City. Many heads of state from throughout the world were present at the United Nations General Assembly. And right now we're going to play the speech of Republic of Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe that was delivered on September 26th of 2013, where he discusses the need for reform within the United Nations system. Let's listen in.
Of the General Assembly, I have the honor to welcome to the United Nations His Excellency Robert Mugabe, President of the Republic of Zimbabwe, and to invite him to address the Assembly.
Your Excellency, the President of the 68th session of the United Nations General Assembly, Mr. John William Ash. Your Excellency, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Ban Ki-moon. Your Excellencies, heads of state and government, distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, comrades and friends, let me begin by extending warmest congratulations to you, Mr. John William Ash, on your election as president of the 68th session of the General Assembly. Your election to this esteemed office is a befitting tribute to the personal and diplomatic qualities that you have exhibited over the years. Mr. President, throughout the world, peace and development have remained dominant themes of our times. People all over the world have been raising their voices in favor of peace, development and cooperation, and against war, poverty, and confrontation. Here at the United Nations, we all acknowledge that peace, security, development, and human rights are the pillars of the United Nations system and the cornerstones of our collective well-being. In this regard, the theme for this session, the post-2015 agenda, setting the stage, is quite pertinent and timely as it gives fresh impetus to our undertaking that achieving the internationally agreed development goals, including the MDGs, and mapping the way forward beyond 2015 requires our collective efforts. The United Nations, as the Center for International Cooperation, should lead in promoting the envisaged development. Mr. President, 13 years ago, our global efforts were mobilized behind the Millennium Development Goals, and we now have less than 1,000 days to meet those targets. Our review and stock-taking exercise revealed that while there have been some significant achievements, there are still gaps and unevenness in the attainment of these goals. In the case of Zimbabwe, we have made progress towards achieving universal access to primary education, combating HIV and AIDS, malaria, and TB. Some of the goals, however, are due to lack of capacity, mainly financial, off track, and in some areas progress has stalled, including in those areas relating to the eradication of poverty and hunger, child mortality, universal access to maternal and reproductive health, environmental sustainability, and access to potable water and sanitation. As a country, we are committed to undertake coordinated efforts to accelerate progress to complete the unfinished business of the MDGs in the remaining period to 2015. Any unachieved goals by then should be integrated into the post-2015 development agenda. Mr. President, Zimbabwe fully shares and supports the emerging consensus that eradicating poverty in all its dimensions should be the overarching goal of our post-2015 agenda. Eradicating poverty by 2030 may be an ambitious goal, but it is attainable if we mobilize our collective efforts. Building on the foundation of the MDGs, the post-2015 agenda should go beyond the social development agenda of the MDGs and achieve structural transformation in our economies that delivers inclusive and sustainable growth. We expect a shift that will bring about industrialization, decent jobs, and qualitative change to the lives of our citizens. We are determined to modernize our infrastructure and ensure access to sustainable energy for all, food security and nutrition. However, we recognize that we cannot do this in isolation from other partners. In the same vein, we also support calls to prioritize gender equality, the health-related MDGs, education, and environmental sustainability in the post-2015 development agenda, among other issues. These are critical issues in our quest to achieve sustainable development for all our people. Mr. President, the lofty objectives of the United Nations Charter in the economic arena will remain unfulfilled unless all members join in efforts genuinely and seriously to address challenges that developing countries face in their pursuit of development, including meeting the MDGs. It is therefore imperative that our discussions address what has so far been the weakest link, the means of implementation. It must be understood that in addition to national efforts, substantial international support and an enabling international economic environment are essential if the MDGs are to be achieved by 2015, especially in Africa. It is therefore important to fulfill the commitments made to support Africa in various international fora. The United Nations should track the fulfillment of these commitments. Mr. President, Zimbabwe supports the reform of the United Nations to strengthen the central role in promoting multilateralism and to be effective in tackling current and future global challenges. We are convinced that the reform will strengthen the organization's capacity to fully promote and implement the principles and objectives of the United Nations Charter and improve its democratic decision-making. In this regard, the reforms in the economic and social actions of the United Nations remain of fundamental importance to us. Our firm belief in multilateral cooperation means that we place a premium on the ability of the United Nations system to deliver efficient development cooperation. The democratic transformation of the architecture of the international financial system is quintessential, as is a root and branch reform of the international trading system. The terms of trade have hugely burdened developing countries for too long. Mr. President, Zimbabwe supports the ongoing efforts to revitalize the General Assembly, which is the most representative organ of the United Nations. We believe that the General Assembly should take the lead in setting the global agenda and restore its primacy that has over the years been encroached upon by other organs. We cannot accept situations whereby the United Nations Security Council is increasingly encroaching on issues that traditionally fall within the General Assembly's purview and competence, including in the area of norm setting, Indeed, recent events have revealed that its formal decisions, that is the decisions of the General Assembly, of the Security Council rather, have provided camouflage to neo-imperialist forces of aggression, seeking to militarily intervene in smaller countries in order to effect regime change and acquire complete control of their wealth. This was so in Libya, where in the name of protecting civilians, NATO forces were deployed with an undisclosed mission to eliminate Gaddafi and his family. A similar campaign had been undertaken in Iraq by the Bush and Blair forces in the false name of eradicating weapons of mass destruction, which Saddam Hussein never possessed. We appreciate the central role that the United Nations should play in furthering multilateralism in preference to unilateralism. In this regard, we applaud the consultations and negotiations on the eventful destruction of the chemical weapons in Syria. My country expresses its gratitude and appreciation to Russia and China for their principled stand on Syria. We hope and trust that the Syrian people will soon sit in dialogue to discuss peace and desirable political reforms. Those Western countries in pursuit of hegemony, as they pretend to be advocates of democracy, must be resisted. Mr. President, for Africa, the reform of the United Nations Security Council is especially long overdue. The anachronistic and unrepresentative character of the Security Council must be redressed. For how long should Africa continue to be denied the right to play a pivotal role in the United Nations Security Council as it decides measures on conflicts within its own borders? The Security Council needs to be more representative, democratic, transparent, accountable, and accessible to the wider membership for its decisions to have more legitimacy. Africa's case for the correction of the glaring historical injustice of being unrepresented in the permanent category and underrepresented in the non-permanent category has been made through the clear, fair, and well-articulated Ezulwini consensus. Zimbabwe remains steadfast in its support of the Ezulwini consensus, which in fact is a demand. Mr. President, Zimbabwe strongly condemns the use of unilateral economic sanctions as a foreign policy tool to effect regime change. Thus, the illegal economic sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe by the United States and the European Union violate fundamental principles of the United Nations Charter on state sovereignty and non-interference in the domestic affairs of a sovereign state. Moreover, these illegal sanctions continue to inflict economic deprivation and human suffering on all Zimbabweans. In the eyes of our people, the sanctions constitute a form of hostility and violence against them for the simple crime of undertaking the land reform program by which land was put in the hands of the then majority landless Zimbabweans. Our small and peaceful country is threatened daily by covetous and bigoted big powers whose hunger for domination and control of other nations and their resources knows no bounds. Shame, 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 we say to the United States of America. Shame, 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 we say to Britain and its allies who have continued to impose sanctions, illegal sanctions upon our people. Zimbabwe is for Zimbabweans, so are its ample resources. Please, may this country remove their illegal and iniquitous sanctions from my peaceful country. If these sanctions were intended to effect regime change, well, the results of the recent national elections have clearly shown them that they cannot achieve their regime change agenda. Mr. President, we are preached to daily by the West on the virtues of democracy and freedom, which they do not totally espouse. Zimbabwe took up arms precisely to achieve freedom and democracy. There was none during colonialism, and it was British colonialism for that matter. Yet we have been punished by the United States through the odious Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act enacted in 2001 to effect regime change in the country. Now this malicious intent to continue the relentless persecution of our small peaceful country has shown itself again through the USA's rejection of the recent absolutely democratic and fair election results of our July 31st general election, even as they were applauded by the African Union and all our regional organizations. It appears that when the United States and its allies speak of democracy and freedom, they are doing so in relative terms. Zimbabwe, however, refuses to accept that these Western detractors have the right to define democracy and freedom for it. We paid the greatest sacrifice. We paid the ultimate price for it, for freedom and independence in Zimbabwe. And we remain determined never to relinquish our sovereignty, as at the same time we remain masters of our destiny. As we have repeatedly and loudly said and asserted, Zimbabwe will never be a colony again. I want to thank you for listening.
And that was the speech by the Republic of Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe at the 68th United Nations General Assembly that took place just this last past month. And, of course, President Mugabe spoke to the United Nations on September 26th of 2013 in his annual address to that august body. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. We'd like to remind our listeners that this program will be available over the Internet. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. In order to access this program, all you have to do is log on to blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And you can have access to this program as well as other programs. Like to remind you once again that we want share this information as broadly as possible. This is Abayomi Ezekwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Thank you.